Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith. We'd be glad to hear from you today. You can call in with those questions. We'll talk about them. Sometimes people will disagree with me about something. That's very common. In fact, I shouldn't say sometimes, probably all the time someone does. That being so, you're welcome to call, and we can discuss any such disagreements you might have. We'd be glad to do so. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. We have a couple of lines open. You can probably get on if you call right away. A couple of announcements for this Saturday, both of them in Southern California. Once a month, we have a men's Bible study in Temecula in the morning, Saturday morning, the first Saturday, or third Saturday of the month, excuse me. And that's happening this Saturday in Temecula, morning study for men. And then we also have in the evening on the third Saturday of the month, gathering for anybody who'd like to join us in Buena Park in Orange County. Now, we take a different book of the Bible each time, and we'll be going through or looking at having an introduction and a thorough introduction and a summary, I should say, of the book of Ephesians. So Ephesians is our book this time, this Saturday night. If you're interested in joining us, I know we got a lot of listeners in California. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Look under announcements, and you'll see all the information of time and place for these gatherings. And that's this Saturday coming up. Go to thenarrowpath.com under announcements for any information you may wish to have to join us this Saturday. Speaking of which, a young man is on the line that I have met at our Buena Park meetings a few times, Jericho from Tustin. Good to hear from you, Jericho.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Steve. I'm looking forward to going again this Saturday.
Great.
Hey, so my girlfriend and I, we belong to a Reformed church, even though we are not Reformed ourselves. And so last night at our discipleship group, there was a woman who opened up about how her mom being unsaved has caused a large blow to her faith. And so she sought counsel from the rest of the group. And the responses that she got from the group offered no comfort to her and actually left her even more upset, although she kept that part to herself. In one of the responses, someone said, "I understand it might be hard to think that your mother might be a vessel of wrath prepared for destruction, but we need to be faithful in his sovereign plan," and so on. And so we've been told also to not share our beliefs about salvation with the others in the church because they say it would create division among the church. And so when we see one of our friends struggling like this and we're told to keep silent, I start to have some doubts. And so although the messages preached on Sunday are great, I'm wondering if it's time to look for a different church that's not really dominated by Calvin, but by Christ. Yeah. And so I'd love your input on how to navigate the situation. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that is definitely a problem that sometimes arises in Calvinism. Calvinism, for those who don't know it listening today, Calvinism teaches that God has selected or elected some people, but not all people, to be saved. And that if he hasn't put your name on his list to be elect, you can't be saved. It can't happen. Only God can elect you. And he did that or didn't do it before you were born. So once you're born, you're already determined either to go to heaven or go to hell, essentially what they say. Which means, of course, when someone's concerned about their mother who's not a believer or their children who are not believers, the Calvinist view is, well, your mother or your children, like yourself, are either elect or they're not elect. If they are elect, they will get saved. If they're not elect, they won't and can't. Now, of course, this means, of course, that they really don't have any choice. Now, some Calvinists say, well, you do have some choice. You have what they call compatibilist free choice, which means you have some choice that's within the realm of being compatible with God, having made all the choices. And not sure exactly how that works logically, but that's what they say. Other Calvinists make it very clear. No, we don't have any free choice. God made all the choices. He's preordained everything. We're just playing out the script, you know, whether we know it or not. We feel like we're making choices, but God's already made all the choices we're going to make for us. Calvinists don't all take the same view on that, but they all do agree that a person will not be saved unless God has pre-elected them to be saved. And since he did that before they were born, everyone's born either predestined to go to hell or predestined to go to heaven. That's not very comforting, especially if some of your relatives are not believers and give some evidence of maybe not being among the elect. You'd like to think that you can persuade them, you know, that you can prevail on them. But if they're not elect, you can't. It won't do any good. Obviously, a Calvinist would say, well, you should still try to prevail upon them, because if you succeed, it proves they were elect. But still, it kind of makes a person despondent to think, well, I might be putting a lot of emotional energy and a lot of time into trying to win this person to Christ when God doesn't even want them saved. If God wanted them saved, he'd elect them. But if they're not elect, he didn't want them saved. So why should I want them saved? Why should I care about them if God doesn't care about them? Of course, the answer is we don't know who he cares about and who he doesn't. We don't know who he elected and who he didn't. So we got to kind of act like we care about all of them, because we don't know which ones God doesn't care about. But it still comes down to the fact that some of the people we care about, God doesn't. Some of the people we love, he doesn't. Some of the people we would love to see saved, he wouldn't. It just comes down to that. There's no other way to put it. In other words, we are more loving towards some people than God is, although the Bible says God is love. This doctrine is very discouraging, and it's very unscriptural, of course. It's not a doctrine any of the apostles taught or any of the first leaders of the church for the first 3 or 4 centuries. It's a doctrine that came up about 4 centuries after Christ, and it has dominated the Reformed movement. And it's, you know, some people say, well, that's great assurance of salvation. It shows how great God's grace is. Others look at it, you know, stand back a little bit and say, well, shows how great his grace is toward a few people, but how unmerciful he is to everyone else that he didn't choose. So, I mean, this is something that people get very emotional about, and understandably. But should you leave a church if they teach that? I would say maybe what you should do is feel yourself free to speak the truth to this woman and people like her. And if the church says you can't stay and do that, well, then they've made the decision for you. In other words, if I was going to a Reformed church and was otherwise happy with, you know, the godliness of the people, the love in the fellowship, the humility of the pastor, the things that make a church good, I would not leave just because I disagree with their theology on that. But if they said you can't tell the truth, or you can't tell what you believe is true from the Bible without being thrown out of the church, well, then that proves that the pastor isn't as humble as I thought he was. You know, they're not as loving as I thought they were. I mean, the things that make a church worthy to be in is that it's got humble and godly leaders, and it's got a humble and godly and loving congregation. And frankly, if somebody gets very inflexible about their Calvinism, and they say, if you're not a Calvinist, you can't really be among us, then it shows they are neither humble nor loving, and probably not as godly as one might have wished to give credit for. So if they make the decision for you, then yeah, be thrown out. I don't say make trouble. I just say, just do what the Holy Spirit would certainly lead you to do. If you see a woman in distress over this, for you to share with her that there is a real possibility that she could be persuaded to come to Christ, and that, you know, prayer can change things and so forth, then say that. And, you know, it might make the Sunday school group wince, or make the pastor uncomfortable. But if they go so far as say, hey, we don't want you here anymore because you say those things, then you know whether to stay or not. You leave then. So that's how I would take it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Steve. I really appreciate that. I'll see you this Saturday.
Okay, Jericho. God bless you. I'm sorry that's happening in your church. All right, let's talk to Todd from Utah. Todd, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Hey, I just have a question about yesterday's call. The first caller, the woman, was asking about God of the Old Testament compared to Jesus of the New Testament.
Uh-huh.
And how the Old Testament, with all the killings and stuff.
Yeah.
I just feel like you didn't answer the question the way that I think she wanted it to be answered. And a lot of people...
What did you understand her question to be? What did you understand her question to be?
What was the difference? Why in the Old Testament is God so vengeful, killing a lot of people compared to the New Testament with Jesus being so loving?
That's precisely what I answered. I said it isn't so.
But the examples you'd never throw out, though, are, okay, like Sodom and Gomorrah, about all the battles where God commands them to kill all the women and the children.
Oh, those were in her question. I didn't have to throw those out. Those were part of her question. That was some of her reasons for asking.
But I think that's what she was coming across, because she was wondering, why is God so vengeful?
Yeah, I think maybe you don't remember what I said, but what would you, how would you have preferred to answer that question? What would you have said to her?
Well, I don't know, because sometimes I'm shocked too in the Old Testament when I see about all the, it's because of sin and everything, but I don't.
Well, if you go back and listen to yesterday's
person, don't understand it.
If you go back on the app or our website and listen to that call again on yesterday's show, I think you'll find I addressed it quite directly. I said we have the impression that God is vengeful in reading some of the Old Testament, but he doesn't act really any differently there than he does in the New Testament. And especially if you compare the book of Revelation, which is in the New Testament, there's every bit as much vengeance and judgment and so forth as you find in any part of the Old Testament, including some of the same kind. You find fire and brimstone, just like you do in Sodom and Gomorrah. You find it in Revelation. You find the plagues, like the plagues of Egypt in Revelation. You find very much the same kind of activity in the book of Revelation as you find in the Old Testament. And this is the New Testament God. This is the Lamb, Jesus, who's doing these things in Revelation. So my position is God isn't any different. Now, the position I went further to explain, God is very loving toward individuals, but when it comes to governing the universe or governing history, there are times when you can't let a cancer grow without removing it. And some societies become cancerous. They become deadly upon the human race. And so removing them is something that God is able to do and committed to, because he loves humanity. Because you love your child, if your child has a brain tumor, you're going to hope a surgeon will be merciless toward that brain tumor and take it out and not worry about whether it dies or lives. You don't want it in the head. You remove it. That's because you love your child, and God loves humanity. And when there's people who are their continued existence is a danger to the well-being of humanity, God, although he tolerates it for very long, usually hundreds of years before he acts, he finally says, okay, I can't take any more. We're going to have to take this out. And he does. And that's what he did with the Canaanites. That's what he did with Sodom and Gomorrah. So, I mean, I said all those things yesterday, so I shouldn't have to say them all again today. But I'm not really sure how you would address that differently. I mean, I'm just telling you what the Bible does say about it. And I think maybe...
No, I agree with you. I'm just saying the average person, I think, still doesn't understand. They think God is so, full of wrath and wants to kill everybody, and Jesus is so loving. But,
that's what I was addressing, that Jesus is just like his Father. And the Father is just like Jesus. Jesus, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Jesus is said to be the exact image and representation of God. We might say, well, I object to Jesus, too, doing those things. I mean, I object to Jesus judging wicked nations, and I object to God judging wicked nations, so forth. Well, then you and God have a controversy, and that doesn't surprise me, because people do. One of the narratives of the Bible is that mankind has fallen and is sinful, and to a very large degree in rebellion against God. And when God seeks to impose his standards, they fight it. And they fight it sometimes very violently. And when he doesn't impose his standards, they go very far afield into very dangerous conduct that God forbids people to do. Now, when we come to the Bible, we see that God is, as it were, at war with the part of humanity that's at war against him. And whenever God's at war with somebody else, he wins, because he's bigger than all of them combined. But they didn't have to. They started it. They started the fight. If the nations want to cast his chains off them, and he sits in the heavens and laughs and says, sorry, I'm going to win this one anyway. I guess we have to decide, am I on God's side or on the bad guy's side? And I think when people say God is being too severe here, I think they're saying, I'm on the side of the bad guys. Now, see, as a Christian, I'm on the side of God. And it doesn't really matter what that involves. I'm always on his side. If he does things that I think, well, I didn't know that that was called for, I have to assume that God knows it's called for. If something God does strikes me as maybe more severe than I would have thought, well, I have to realize that God knows more about the situation than I do, and he's never done anything wrong. He's perfectly just and more loving than any parent toward a child. And therefore, if God and I have a disagreement, God's not the one who's mistaken or wrong. God's not the one who has to change to accommodate me. God is the one who's perfect, all wise, all good, all loving. And if I have a conflict with him, it's because I'm not those things. I'm not all good or all loving or all wise. And therefore, the smartest thing I as a human being could do is when I find, wow, God did something I wouldn't have done that. Well, the smartest thing for me to do is saying, well, I guess, but what if I knew as much as he did about it? Would I do that? If I was as good and loving and just and powerful and as committed to the well-being of humanity as he is, I guess I probably would do that. But I'm not. I don't know those things he knows. I don't have all the virtues he has. Nonetheless, I mean, this is something that you'll find people are often reacting. Certainly, it's one of the things that atheists bring up a lot. Oh, God's so cruel. Well, he's not cruel. He's just. And, if there's a criminal, let's just say somebody is a, repeat violent criminal. And let's say he's on a subway and someone stops him. And let's say he's done things that are in the criminal code are really worthy of death. And he gets killed on the subway. Okay. Now, am I going to be on the side of the criminal or on the side of justice? That's really what I have to ask myself. When it comes to the dispute between God and rebellious man, I'm always on God's side because that's always the side of justice. And I'm always going to be against those who, for no good reason, have made themselves his enemies. Now, that means I'm not going to struggle with the same problems that people have who haven't made that their commitment. Some people may read the Bible. They're not sure if they're on God's side or not. They're waiting to see if he does things they like him to do. They're waiting to see if he thinks like they think, if he evaluates things the way they do, if he does the things that that they would naturally think they should do. And if he doesn't do those things, then he's got a lot of questions to answer, as far as they're concerned. See, I never approach God that way. I never assume he has any questions that he has to answer to me. Who am I that God should have to answer to me? I just figure God has never been wrong yet. I've been wrong lots of times. Given his track record and mine, if he and I disagree, I'm probably the one who's wrong, and I'm willing to say so. When somebody isn't willing to say that, then they can butt their heads against the brick wall of justice and truth, but it's not the wall that's going to get hurt. And that's how I understand these issues. That's how I approach them. I can understand how people find some things God does not what they'd prefer, but what God prefers to do is based on his wisdom and his knowledge and his love and his seeing the big picture, all of which I lack, and he does not. So I'm just on his side. That's just where I stand. If somebody isn't, they don't have to take the position I do, and they will have problems with some things in the Bible because the Bible wasn't written to coddle them or to affirm them or to make them think this is how things should be done. That's how I would do them. No, the Bible's written to show us what God does and what God thinks and so forth. And since he's the ultimate reality in the universe and the one with whom we have to do, the one that we will be judged by, the one that will our eternal destiny is related to our relationship to him, well, I think it's a smart person who decides to get their head straightened out and adjust it to thinking like God does about things. If they don't want to, they have free will. And, of course, there will be consequences. Dwight from Denver, welcome.
Hi, Steve. I was wondering your opinion of Ron Wyatt, who I guess he died in 1999, but he claimed to have made all these biblical discoveries, the Ark of the Covenant, the Noah's Ark, the Ten Commandments. He even said
Sinai.
He claimed that, and the real site of the crucifixion, and on and on it goes. And I know a lot of people are fascinated with this stuff, and I just don't get it because I think it's all bogus.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can't say it's all bogus because I'm not an archaeologist, and he wasn't either. I mean, he wasn't a professional archaeologist. He was an amateur archaeologist of the Seventh-day Adventist background, I believe. And he did claim to find all kinds of things that the real archaeologists would love to find. Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant, you know, the real Mount Sinai, and so forth. He claimed that he found all these things, and most archaeologists don't take him seriously. Now, the thing is, some of the things he said that he found, if they are really there, anyone could walk over there and see it. You know, anyone, any archaeologist could find it. What's interesting is that mainstream archaeologists do not believe that Noah's Ark has been found or that the Ark of the Covenant has been found. Now, I'm kind of on Ron Wyatt's side, I think, about the where Mount Sinai is, but he's not the first person to discover that. I mean, there's others besides him, but he did do some work on that as well. I think that a person who's not a professional archaeologist can, of course, if he's good at it, find things that have not been found by others yet. But if he has really found them, then mainstream archaeology will agree to it. They'll see it. I mean, they don't want to be ignorant of what's been found. Some might say, well, because he's not one of them, he's not a professional, they don't want to credit him with that. Well, then, you know, I can hardly believe that a mainstream archaeologist would rather stay ignorant of something that somebody else has found just because he doesn't want to give them the credit for finding
it,
you know. So
yeah.
I honestly, I have my serious doubts. I take everything that Ron Wyatt says with a grain of salt. And you're right, he's dead now, but when he was alive, I was, you know, his books were around and stuff. I heard him speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said that he never really produced any hard evidence.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of what he found strikes me as being urban legends, you know, kind of things. But, but you know, I'm not here to be his critic. But when people ask me what I think about him, this is what I think. I think if he really found those things, then everybody would know it. And we could go, there'd be, you could go to a museum now and see the Ark of the Covenant. Or you could go to, pay to go look at the Ark of Noah, in Noah's Ark. I mean, in Turkey or wherever. I mean, the fact that that isn't so tells me pretty convincingly they haven't been found.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he claims that he found them, and yet I think evidence is that they haven't been found, is what makes me form a rather negative opinion of some of his claims.
Right. Okay. Thank you. That helps a lot.
Okay, Dwight. Great talking to you, Ian. God bless
you. Have a good one.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
We're coming up on the break at the bottom of the hour. It's amazing how fast this goes. We have another half hour coming up, and we'll be taking more calls. We have one line open at the moment. If someone wants to jump onto that line, it's 844-484-5737. At this point in the show, I just like to make sure people know that there's a reason you've heard no commercials in the first half hour, and you will hear no commercials in the second half hour. And you're not hearing a commercial right now because we're not selling anything. But we do like to let you know, we do have a budget. We do have to spend money to put this on the radio. We buy time on radio stations. We've just had two new radio stations approach us about going on. As far as I know, I think we're a little bit maxed out. I don't know how many stations we're on. Someone told me about 70 across the country, and they're very expensive. But a couple new ones in eastern Kentucky, I heard, might become possible to go on. But I'm not sure if we have the money for it. In any case, whether we do or not, we've been on the air for 26 years paying for time on radio stations. And that's all we do is just let our audience know. You know, we don't have sponsors. We don't have sales. We don't sell anything. We just want you to know that the program is on the air for free to you, but not free to us. And Since we won't sell you anything, we are listener supported. If you want to support us and keep us on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Now, it's also possible to donate through our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. Now, thenarrowpath.com, if you've not been there, you're missing out. There's literally thousands of resources at our website, and they're free. A very large number of these are MP3 files of in-depth Bible teaching through all the books of the Bible, as well as on scores, if not hundreds, of topics. That's at thenarrowpath.com. You can listen to those things for free. You can download them. There's an app, thenarrowpath.com. There's also some pretty cool other websites, like Matthew 7:13.com. There's a topical index of calls from this show you can listen to. There's another one called OpenTheo.com, which has transcripts of lectures. Just check it out. At thenarrowpath.com, you'll see links to those as well. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
In a 16-lecture series entitled The Authority of Scriptures, Steve Gregg not only thoroughly presents the case for the Bible's authority, but also explains specifically how this truth is to be applied to a believer's daily walk and outlook. The Authority of Scriptures, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures, can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from our website, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you want to balance comment on some issue where you might not see things quite the same way as the host, feel free to give me a call. Right now the lines are full, so you'd get a busy signal if you call now, but if you take this number down and dial it or punch it in or whatever you do with numbers these days, in a few minutes, you'll find lines have opened up. You could probably get through. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right, and I want to remind you, we have a couple of meetings in Southern California this Saturday. We got a morning men's Bible study in Temecula and an evening meeting where we're looking at the book of Ephesians in Buena Park, both this Saturday. You can get information about that from our website, thenarrowpath.com, under announcements. All right, our next caller today is Chris from Colorado Springs. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you. Hello, Steve. Continue to be blessed by your ministry and so thankful for what you do. Hey, I was recently looking for some commentary on Proverbs 16:4. And I looked in the verse-by-verse teaching that you did in Proverbs, as well as searching the topic and the verse on Matthew 7:13, and I couldn't find anything. So I thought I'd just call and see what you have to say about that. We're Calvinists to bring that verse up.
Yeah, I have sometimes brought that verse up in connection with the question of the origins of Satan, too, because it basically says God, the Lord, has made all things for himself. Yes, even the wicked, for the day of doom. Now, Calvinists would say that this means that God made the wicked to be wicked because he wanted to glorify himself in destroying them. So the day of doom that's coming upon them is the purpose that God made them for. I can see how those words could be taken that way, though, frankly, I don't think you can make such a stark doctrine from a proverb. Since Proverbs are not even primarily theological statements so much as wisdom statements, but this certainly makes a theological comment of some kind. I think the way this would normally be taken, unless someone is wedded to a Calvinistic paradigm, would be that God has made everything, not just the good things. He's made everything. Even the bad things were made by him. And he's got the proper end in store for each one. He's made the righteous, and he's made the wicked. Just like he said to Moses in Exodus, I think it was in chapter 3 or 4, when he said, who made the lame, who made the blind, who made, you know, the deaf, did not I, the Lord? He didn't say why he made them that way, but he's made everyone. He made people who are well, and he made people who are disabled. He made people who are, as you meet them, they are good people or bad people. But all of them are made by God and therefore subject to his judgment. Now, the category of evil exists because God gave people free will. And he has something in mind for people who make that choice, and that is the day of doom. He made them. He didn't make them evil. He made them, and they became evil, but they are evil. So when it says that God made the evil, it doesn't necessarily mean he made them to be evil, but they are evil people, and they are still people that God made, and therefore they are subject to his judgment, and the day of doom awaits them. So that's how I would probably see it. I don't think that there's enough in the Bible to support the Calvinist idea of it.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, it is worded in a way that's ambiguous, certainly. And there are a number of passages that are kind of ambiguous, which people with different doctrinal views can see through their lens. But when you look at the whole paradigm of the biblical narrative, I don't think it would support the Calvinist ideas about that verse or any other verse.
Right.
All right, Chris.
That makes sense to think of it as him creating everybody.
Right.
Not that he created them to be wicked, but if they turn out to be wicked, then they'll suffer the day of doom.
Right. That's what I think.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you, Steve.
All right, Chris. God bless you. Bye now. All right. Jackson from Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm calling with a bit of a disagreement, bit of a question regarding Matthew 18:22.
Okay.
Where Jesus is basically saying, you know, not just seven times you forgive the sin, but 70 times seven.
Uh-huh.
And I listened to your verse-by-verse analysis on this, and I've heard you bring it up a couple of times on the radio, where it seems like you're taking the position that, you know, 70 times seven, that's so many that it's like, it's basically infinite, and you should be, you know, forgiving these sins kind of forever and forever and forever.
Uh-huh.
But I guess to me that it feels like if Jesus wanted you to do that, he would have said that. And then in the parable following, where we have the example of the king who forgives the debt to the servant, right? He forgives this, you say it's like equivalent to $1 million debt. He forgives it all, but he does, or at least to my knowledge, it seems like he says, okay, enough is enough, though. He doesn't go on and give him another $1 million. He sort of is able to say, I've forgiven you so many times, I kind of lay my pants off this situation. And I guess I'm calling sort of the context here is I have a friend in an abusive relationship who's sort of the mindset that you have to just keep on forgiving, you know, every day kind of for the rest of your life. And I'm feeling to me that that doesn't seem like, you know, that Jesus wants her to be beaten forever, right? But I don't know. I just wanted to get your take on that.
Well, forgiving someone doesn't mean you let them beat you up. That's a very different subject. Forgiving somebody means you give up your right to hold a grudge against them. You give up your right to demand that they make good on something that they've done wrong to you. You just release that. Now, that doesn't mean that you also, for example, there was once a guy who wanted to kill me. And I was walking down the street once in Santa Cruz, and I looked, you know, behind me, and his car, with him driving it, was on the sidewalk that I was walking on, coming, you know, screaming down the sidewalk in his car. And now, I have forgiven that guy. I don't hold it against him. But I didn't stay in harm's way. I actually got off the sidewalk and went up to the porch of a nearby house where he couldn't drive his car up on there. So, in other words, you don't have to stay in harm's way just because you forgive somebody who's putting you in harm's way. That's a very different issue. Now, if this person is being abused, I assume you're talking about a woman abused by a husband, if you think that her forgiving him means that she has to stay there under his roof where he can continue abusing her, I certainly would never make that case. I've actually said the opposite every time I've been asked about it. I believe that a person, although I don't think she would necessarily have grounds for divorce simply because she's experienced abuse, divorce is much more serious than that, and marriage is much more serious than that as far as God's concerned. But I don't think that she has to stay in the house. I believe that if a woman or her children are in danger in their home, the smart thing for them to do is to go to a safe place, maybe to her parents' house, or maybe to a safe house somewhere else, or maybe some other situation, but and to stay there until it's safe to go home. But the fact that she does go to a safe place doesn't mean she doesn't forgive. You see, if she doesn't forgive, that means that she wants to see retaliation done to him. She's holding a grudge against him. Now, you don't have to hold a grudge against someone in order to say, I think that person has demonstrated I can't really trust them. You don't have to trust people. The Bible never commands us to trust people. In fact, it says, woe unto him who puts his trust in man. Trusting people is not a Christian obligation, but loving people is. And loving means that you will sacrifice for them, you wish them well, you'll work for their good if you can, you'll pray for them. This is loving them. This is being on their, you're on their side in terms of the need of their soul, and you wish them to have a better life. But that doesn't mean you trust them. And so the situation you're raising is different than that. Now, you mentioned the parable that follows the statement about 70 times 7. I'm not sure if Jesus didn't mean keep forgiving until you've lost count and then keep doing it after that. I'm not sure how we would take it. I guess we can either take it non-literally, as I am, to mean, hundreds of times. Just do it, until you lose count. Just keep doing it. Or we could take it, I guess, literally. In which case, you need to keep track. You better keep a checkbox. And every time that person does it, check it off until you get to 490 and then say, okay, that's all. 490, that's the limit. I don't think a case can be made for Jesus meaning that. And as far as the parable he tells, it's not a parable about anyone forgiving someone even more than once. It's a parable about the need to forgive. And the king forgave the servant a great debt. As far as we know, he only did it one time. He wasn't asked to do it a second time. And then the person who was forgiven went out and found somebody else who owed him a debt and wouldn't forgive him. As far as we know, that only happened one time too. But the one who wouldn't forgive after he was forgiven was seen by the king as violating the terms of his forgiveness. And therefore, he was put in jail. So, you can forgive someone on the terms that I'm not going to punish you or hold this debt against you, but on the terms that you show the same mercy to others. That was, frankly, what was implied in it. And the servant didn't do that, so he went to jail for not doing it. It doesn't mean that the man, the king, imposed the first debt on him again. Sometimes it seems that way, but he couldn't. Of course, he forgave the debt. If a debt is forgiven, it's gone. He can't come back and say, okay, I don't like what you did, so I'm putting it back on you. No, the debt that the man was forgiven imposed on him a new debt, and that was a debt of forgiving others. That was apparently implied in the agreement. He didn't owe the money anymore, but he owed it to his fellow man to be forgiving. He didn't do that, so he was put in prison, given over to torturers until he should pay what was owed, which was forgiving other people is what was owed. So that's how I understand it. But, I think you're... Whether we say that 70 times 7 is simply shorthand for saying forever, or whether it literally means 490 times, I think a much better case can be made for the former than for the latter. But in any case, it doesn't have anything to do with a woman staying in harm's way when she's getting beaten by a man.
All right. That clears things up. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Jackson. All right, we're going to talk next to Tim from La Mesa, California. Tim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I had a question about Augustine and Calvinism. Uh-huh. I've heard you say that he introduced those ideas into the church, and I was wondering what happened historically so that the Catholic Church didn't become Calvinist.
Well, they followed Augustine in many teachings, but not so much on that one. Augustine wrote thousands and thousands of pages of theology, and he introduced a lot of things that are pretty common in the church now that weren't really taught before. The view of original sin that most Christians hold was introduced by Augustine, for example. The doctrines of grace, as the Calvinists call them, were introduced by Augustine. The idea that the churches are subject to the Bishop of Rome was an Augustinian doctrine, too. And therefore, he becomes the father of Roman Catholicism. He's also the father of the Reformation and of many other well-known doctrines. It's not like Augustine was a bishop or a pope or something like that, that people had to go along with him. It's just that his influence was tremendous. I don't know if anybody went along with Augustine on everything. For example, the Reformers were Augustinians, but they didn't go along with him on the pope issue, you know. And the Catholic Church, for the most part, did not go along with him on the sovereign election issues, and that's what the Reformers glommed onto. But, yeah, I don't know how the Catholic Church decided which parts of Augustine to follow, which parts not, but probably the same way that I would. I'm not Augustinian, but some things Augustine said are good. I mean, I would just weigh them against Scripture. And that's what we should do with any theologian, including Augustine or Aquinas or any other great theologian, supposedly great.
Oh, okay. Thanks for the information. All right. Thank you.
Okay, Tim. Good talking to you. Thanks for your call. All right, let's talk to Kurt from New Braunfels, Texas. Is that right?
New Braunfels. Yes.
Braunfels. Okay.
Yes.
Good to hear from you.
Yep. Hi, Steve. I got some questions. Just the concept of, you've heard hating the sin, love the sinner.
Mm-hmm.
In God's view, is sin actually separate from the sinner?
Because, oh, very much.
Okay. Well, it seems like most of the time this takes place in our minds before, you know, that our actions are a manifestation of, or it's working out what we did in our head, which would, I guess, be tied to our sin nature. So, anyway, I want to explore that. And then also, the question is, you know, God loves people, but does God also hate people, like his enemies?
Yeah.
And, you know, can God love and hate at the same time?
Yeah, just like we can, you know, in a sense. We can love our children and hate certain things they're doing that we see as self-destructive. We can hate the fact that our children are, using fentanyl or cutting themselves or, you know, doing other things that we see as self-destructive things. We can hate that about them. And we can even hate, in a sense, people who are giving them those things that are killing them. But hating them has to do with our emotion. Loving has to do with our commitments and our will. Love, unfortunately, we think of love simply as an extreme form of liking, but it's not. Liking is an emotion. I like some kinds of entertainment, I don't like others. I like some foods, I don't like others. I like some people's personalities, I don't like others. But that's just an emotional. That's just an emotional response to them. They make me happy or they don't make me happy, you know? But that's not what love is. Love is not learning to like them a lot. There may be people who there's absolutely nothing about them that anyone would really like because they only do evil things. But loving is not liking. Loving is doing. When Jesus said, love your neighbors, you love yourself, he explained it, what you would have others do to you, you do that to them. That's what loving is. You do to them what you want done to you. That's how you love them, by your actions. Loving is action. It's a commitment to sacrifice for somebody else's well-being. And you can do that even if someone you don't like. If there may be somebody, I sometimes think of, you know, some of my friends might have kids that I find annoying. But I care about the kids because I care about their parents. Their parents are friends of mine or something, you know, and I know how I feel about my kids, and my kids can be annoying too to others, but I would like for people to love my kids even when they're annoying and to make, you know, to act on their behalf. If one of my kids gets into trouble and is in serious danger and somebody else who doesn't like them much knows of it, I would hope that they would love my kids enough to, maybe because they love me, to intervene. Just like I love everybody because they're God's kids and God loves them. You know, if God's the Father, I love all his kids because he loves them. Now, that means I want the best for them. Now, do I like them all? Certainly not. There's many things I don't like, both in people and in other areas of life. What we like and what we don't, that's simply a matter of taste. Some people just never did like certain foods, and other people in their family grew up liking them. Well, that's just a matter of taste. There's no accounting for taste. So liking something is not the same thing as loving it. And loving it isn't simply liking it more than before. Now, hate can be used to speak of the opposite of love, or it can be the opposite of liking. For example, I can say, I hate going to the dentist, or I hate going through security at airports. I hate that. What it means is I don't like it. I have an emotional reaction to it. Does it mean that I hate the people that I have to that make me go through security, or that I hate the dentist? No, I mean, I've got nothing against them, but they're doing things I hate. I don't hate them as people. I could still love them and still hate the fact that I have to go see them, that I have to be subject to what they're doing. God is that way too. God loved the whole world. Now, the whole world was sinners. There wasn't one non-sinner in the world when it says God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's the greatest love that anyone can show, is to give one's life. And Jesus loved the world. God loved the world. And that's why Jesus died for them. Now, those are sinners we're talking about, including the people that God hates. But see, his hatred for them has more to do with his emotional response to them, not his commitment to them. He loves everyone in the world enough to die for them, and that's real love, and to want the best for them. But like anyone else who's got good sense, some things are annoying, some things are irritating, some things are despicable, some things are intolerable, and some people do those things, and some people become those things in a way. To say God hates that is not to say he doesn't love them. There's a level at which he hates them in that he doesn't like anything about what they're doing, doesn't like anything about what they've become, perhaps, but he still would save them. He would still die for them. He'd still love them. So loving someone has more to do with what you would do for them. Liking has more to do with what you feel toward them. And the word hate could be used, and is used of both. To say I hate something means I really, really, really dislike it. Or it could mean I really would not sacrifice anything for them. I don't love them, you know, but I should love. I should love even my enemies. And what did Jesus say? Love your enemies, do good to those who persecute you, bless those who curse you. This is how you act toward them. It's not how you feel toward them. And so can God love and hate? Yes, if we mean by hate the opposite of liking, the extreme opposite of liking, loathing, finding something loathsome. There's plenty that God finds loathsome, including some people, because they identify with their activities so much, and they choose them out of rebellion. But they still are made in his image, and he still wants them saved. And we know this because he has saved so many people who were like that. That's how I would say, you can love and hate at the same time. Now, I'm thinking I might have missed part of your question as I was talking. Did I leave something out there, Kurt?
Well, the question was about hating the sin and loving the sinner.
That part, yeah.
I guess the question was, is sin always separated from the sinner?
Well, hatred, as I said, can refer to something you don't like, or it can refer to someone you don't love. Now, God loves sinners. God, you know, in this, the love of God was manifested in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, it says in Romans 5. So God loves sinners. He does not love sin, but the reason he doesn't love sin is because sin is the enemy of sinners. Sin is destroying them. Just like a cancer destroys your child. You hate the cancer, but you love your child. It's true that a lot of people think that God, they see God as a God who hates and is angry at sinners, primarily, when the Bible indicates he's, you know, his hatred, of course, in the sense of disliking it, can be towards sinners. He can strongly dislike sinners. And it's sometimes said he hates certain kinds of people in that sense. But they are the same people he died for, the same people he wants to see them saved, which means he actually loves them, even if he doesn't like them.
Yeah.
And we can too. Yeah,
part,
we love
part, the same. I don't know. Maybe this is semantics too, some of it, but... Yeah, I'm trying to work through this.
Well, it is semantics. The question is, what do we mean by hate? Do we mean hate as the opposite of love, or do we mean hate as the opposite of liking? That is semantic. Yeah, but that's what the word hate is used both ways.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Kurt. Hey, thanks for your call. Good talking to you. All right, we don't have very much time left. Sometimes I wonder maybe I should not even give a caller a chance, but they might have only 30 seconds worth of question. Let's talk to Linda from Auburn, Washington. We can't go more than a minute or two. Go ahead.
Okay, fine. I just wanted to relay that with the Noah's, with Ron Wyatt, I looked into his and I took it seriously, his findings, and I did find merit in his findings, and one reason I took it seriously was somebody, a Christian who's good at discerning spirits, who helped, and I even helped him get rid of a bad spirit, discern that he did find real things, and related to him not finding.
Okay, you mean they felt that? They felt that he did.
Right, discerned. He heard from God. And I, the same person, I thought, wow, he seems like a prophet. I told that to somebody. And when I saw him again, he said, you can call me a man of God. So I didn't know that term at the time. So you can see it in the Bible, and you probably know it well. Like in 1 Samuel, there's an anonymous man of God that tells Eli, the priest, something.
Yeah, in the Old Testament, the term man of God usually refers to a prophet. But, you know, just because someone says he's a man of God doesn't mean he's a prophet. Or even if a man says he's a prophet, it doesn't mean he's a prophet. And because a person says they discern something, well, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I've known people who really trusted their gift of discernment tremendously. And they've come up and they said, I discerned that you're thinking so-and-so. And they were wrong. I wasn't thinking about it at all. It hadn't even come to my mind. I mean, they just... Some people have hunches. Sometimes we might call it the gift of suspicion in some cases rather than the gift of discernment. But the truth is that people think they've discerned something, and sometimes they have, sometimes they have not. In this case, I would never decide whether Ron Wyatt actually found the artifacts he said he found by some third party discerning that he's telling the truth. I'd want to find out from someone who actually can produce the artifacts. That's the kind of thing you don't know by discernment, but by investigation. I'm sorry I'm out of time for today. I appreciate your call. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or from our website, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.